goals impacting its adversaries. U.S. sanctions on Venezuela. The U.S. has sanctioned Venezuela for much of this past decade, hoping that crippling its economy would instigate a popular uprising. But that has failed to materialize since Venezuelans have substantially overcome some of these illegal sanctions. We're going to be discussing those points and a whole lot more with Professor Peter Kuznick, director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University, and also Ramon Grossvogel, professor at the University of California at Berkeley, specializing in decolonial studies and political economy of the world system.
Thank you for having me on the show. The excuse that Trump and members of his administration are giving is that Venezuela is in part responsible for the drugs that are flowing into the United States, and that therefore Maduro is a narco-terrorist, and the United States, in order to protect its own national security, is destroying the boats that are carrying the drugs. This is a lie. It's total fabrication. What Trump says we're going after, the U.S. going after, is the fentanyl. Venezuela is not involved in transiting, manufacturing, producing, shipping fentanyl. The U.S. military told members of Congress that the drugs that are on some of these boats are cocaine, not fentanyl. Fentanyl is produced mostly in Mexico. So, number one, that's a lie. Number two, you don't send a vast armada and all these troops, 15,000 troops, to Venezuela, off the coast of Venezuela, to interdict drug boats. So the U.S. wants to invade Venezuela, partly because Venezuela has vast oil reserves. Some say the biggest oil reserves in the world. So that's what Trump is after. And if the U.S. is able to overthrow Maduro and take control of those oil reserves, that would have great impact not only on the world economy, but on global geopolitics.
Venezuela has suffered extreme hardship under illegal U.S. sanctions. An economic embargo has blocked Venezuela from accessing the U.S.-dominated international financial system and prevented Venezuela from exporting its oil and fixing or updating its oil infrastructure, causing government revenue to shrink by a staggering 99%. According to the top U.N. expert on sanctions, the special rapporteur Elena Duhani. However, Venezuela's economy today is in a much better state than it was previously during the previous U.S.-led attempt coup back in 2019 to 2020, which caused hyperinflation. The inflation rate has fallen a lot. Real wages have risen. Food and everyday necessities are affordable right now. The economy has dollarized a lot, however, which erodes the monetary sovereignty of the Venezuelan government.
The U.S. has a number of things in mind. Number one, it wants to seize Venezuela's oil, and that would then flood the market with oil, which would lower the price of oil and therefore have a devastating impact, the U.S. figures, on Russia's economy, on Iran's economy. But also, this is the U.S. way to overthrow the government in Cuba. Cuba is dependent on inexpensive oil from Venezuela. The Cuban economy would be, which is shaky already, would be sunk by cutting off that oil from Venezuela. The U.S. biggest prize in Latin America is, and it's not exactly Latin America, but South America, would be Brazil.
Welcome back. This is the social section of the program. The first item that we are covering for you is, can you imagine what would happen to oil exports if the U.S. really achieved a regime change in Venezuela? No wonder that Russia is so nervous about what's happening there. As the U.S. renews its threats against Venezuela, authorizes a CIA operation, and mobilizes regime change rhetoric, the country is still being denied access to its own gold reserves. $1.8 billion frozen in the Bank of England. It's not about democracy. It's about control of Venezuela's old gold and lithium and punishing nations that resist the empire. The Cartel of the Suns was literally created by the CIA, also known as the Cocaine Import Agency. Max Blumenthal methodically exposes the WMD-level lies justifying U.S. attacks on Venezuela and explain the devastating consequences of a regime change war.
The big lie of this war is the Cartel of the Suns. As Ryan said, the Cartel of the Suns was literally created by the CIA, also known as the Cocaine Import Agency, to ship 22 tons of drugs into the United States in the early 90s through its main point of contact in the pre-Chavez Venezuelan National Guard, General Ramon Guillen.
Former U.S. Ambassador James Story. Maduro is sitting on top of the world's largest oil reserves, minerals that will fuel the 21st century economy, and he's in bed with our strategic competitors. It isn't about narco-trafficking, it certainly is not about democracy. It's about Monroe doctoring imperial domination to steal Venezuela's resources for U.S. corporations.
Thank you for inviting me to the program. The U.S. is in a big crisis. I would say that the U.S. empire is in a terminal crisis. They have lost the commercial wars with China in Africa and Asia. The last remaining space that they have at hand to keep their status as empire is Latin America. But however, in Latin America, there's still a strong presence of China in the markets and of sovereign countries that are challenging U.S. empire in the region. Venezuela is one of the richest countries in the world. It has the largest oil fields in the world. It has one of the countries with the large resources in gas. It's one of the countries with the, you know, largest resources in gold mines, in water, in minerals that are important for artificial intelligence, computers, and military industry. So it's a very wealthy country in terms of resources. And so what the U.S. is trying to do is to recover those resources as a way to recover its, come out of its own crisis. Remember, USA has a debt that is in the trillions. It's around $30 trillion with the letter T. And they need to, in a sense, do something dramatic
in order to recover those resources from a rich country such as Venezuela, because the Bolivarian government has, in a sense, kept sovereignty over its economy and over its natural resources.
One similarity between Venezuela and Syria was the economic warfare waged against them by the West. The Syrian government fell in part because the US-EU Caesar sanctions had devastated the economy. Syria could not get access to hard currency and thus had very high inflation. The major difference, the Western-sponsored war on Syria, which began in 2011, the Syrian state was significantly weakened by more than a decade of war.
The U.S. has a reserve of oil in their own country for another 6 to 7 years. U.S. is now having a situation where in the very short term, they're going to have scarcity of oil. Right now, they don't have any other sources of oil like they used to have in the past, except purchasing the oil at the international markets the way they are cost today. And what they're trying to do in recovering the oil fields of Venezuela, which by the way have the largest oil reserve in the world, okay? Venezuela is the country with the largest oil reserve in the world. What they're trying to do is to have access to oil resources at a cheaper price.
Welcome back. This is the InfoNews section of the program. The first item that we are covering for you is the U.S. hunger. Explainer, why millions sleep on an empty stomach in the U.S., the wealthiest country on earth? On October the 31st, former U.S. President Barack Obama highlighted an issue that is largely overlooked by legacy media but widely debated inside the country. More than 47 million Americans, including 1 in 5 children, don't have reliable, affordable access to nutritious food. And as the cost of living skyrockets, more families are depending on SNAP benefits or food stamps to put food on the table, he wrote in a post on X. The next item is the EU economy. EU blames economic woes on Donald Trump, but forgets who broke the machine. Brussels is preparing to cut growth forecasts for 2026, hinting already that Trump's tariffs and trade uncertainty are dragging Europe down. A neat explanation, especially for a crisis that the EU will spend years engineering with its own hands. The same EU that proudly cut itself off from cheap Russian energy. The next item is cashing in on the Gaza genocide. Gaza war bonanza, how U.S. giants cashed in big on Israel's genocide. Donald Trump is currently seeking congressional approval of a $6.4 billion package of U.S. weapons sales to Israel, including $3.8 billion in Boeing Apache attack helicopters and $1.9 billion for 3,200 to 3,250 infantry assault vehicles. West Coast giants like Microsoft, Google, and Amazon also signed deals to provide cloud computing, AI infrastructure, and data services to the Israeli military. Cloud deals can be worth tens of millions per year per contract. Our next item is oil sales to Israel. According to a report by Oil Change International, 25 countries were responsible for shipping vast amounts of oil to Israel during its two-year Gaza offensive. Azerbaijan, Kazakhstan, Russia, and the U.S. were among the largest suppliers of oil. More than 21 million tons of crude oil and refined fuels, including jet fuel used by military aircraft. Welcome back. This is the in-depth section of the program. The U.S. wants to eliminate the drug trafficking cartels in Venezuela, or at least that is the facade that the U.S. wants other nations to believe. The U.S., in fact, wants Nicolas Maduro gone. This reasoning is slammed internationally and also by the Latin American countries. Why, you ask? It's because they don't want the same fate happening to them. During the time that President Hugo Chavez was in charge of Venezuela, economically speaking, there were many strides made under his socialist system. Let's look at this graph, for example. The unemployment rate in 1999 was 14.5%. It almost halved to 7.6% in 2009. The next item is GDP per capita. In 1999, it was $4,105, while in 2011 it was $10,000, more than $10,000. The currency, let's look at this graph as well. And the inflation, the average consumer prices back in 1999 was 23.6%. In 2012, it was 31.6%. The next item that we are going to have is the extreme poverty rate. In 1999, it was 23.4%, but in 2011, it was 8.5% under Hugo Chavez. And the final one that we are going to have right here is oil exports, the nominal net rates. In 1999, it was $14.4 billion, while in 2011, $60 billion in revenue. The next item is a snapshot of the major sectors of the economy, which dates back to over a decade ago. It's interesting that oil exports back in 2008 were over $43 billion, to have been reduced to $8.62 billion. The U.S. sanctions on the country were a major factor in low GDP per capita, of course, confidence in the government, and of course, inflation, which exploded to unprecedented levels, as you can see. Now, let's bring in our guest, Professor Peter Kuznick, Director of the Nuclear Studies Institute at American University. Professor, is the U.S. flexing muscles against Venezuela to project power over Latin American countries, that if they don't follow the U.S. foreign policy here, they are going to suffer the same fate?
The U.S. is sending a message to all of Latin America, and as it's been sending to the rest of the world. When Trump talked at the beginning about invading Panama, invading Canada, invading Greenland, we saw who he is and what he represents. He said he wants the Nobel Peace Prize and deserves it. I'm the person who nominated last year's winner for the Nobel Peace Prize, the Japanese anti-nuclear group, survivor group, Nihon Hidankyo. I was part of their delegation in Oslo. The only prize that Trump deserves is the biggest warmonger, biggest fascist enabler on the planet right now.
Now, this graph right here shows the extent that the U.S. sanctions affected the Venezuelan economy. In 1999, $334 billion was the GDP of Venezuela, and during Maduro's time, it was reduced down to $68,216,000, a result of harsh U.S. sanctions which cut off Venezuela from the world financial system. The next item looks at the year 2008. Things started to improve for Maduro and his government, and here are the improvements seen in different sectors as reflected in the GDP, which is a drastic improvement compared to figures just a couple of years ago. The economic indicators here shows the improvements. Notice GDP coming in at positive 3%, with inflation caught dramatically, quite an improvement from what it was previously. The economy's rebound was Due to adjusting to sanctions, domestic production and help from countries like Russia, Iran, and China in repairing oil infrastructure allowed oil production to rise above 1 million barrels per day, bringing in more hard currency. One of the lesser known facts is that the U.S. has throughout its history attacked sovereign Latin American countries on many occasions, over 50 times, in wanting regime change or coups to lead to regime change. That is why many of the Latin American countries are against the U.S. warmongering policies, in this case, against Venezuela. Now let's bring in our other guest, Roman Grossvogel, professor at the University of California at Berkeley. Professor, can it be concluded that Donald Trump is after the oil and gas, not only for economic benefits for the U.S., but to be able to control the oil market against countries like in Latin America who are not subservient to the U.S. demands?
USA is trying to destroy the Bolivarian government, and they want to, which is right now the wall that is putting obstacles for the U.S. to have full control over the governments and the economy of the region. Right now, they are in an offensive to destroy all the governments that used to have some kind of sovereignty and claims against U.S. empire. For example, the Correa government in Ecuador was destroyed. The Kirchner's and Fernandez government in Argentina was destroyed. Now the Bolivia government was also, this has been destroyed recently. And now the main country left right now with wealth resources is Venezuela.
As of November the 23rd, the U.S. has announced a new phase of military aggression against Venezuela, with so many U.S. officials saying that the U.S. is very much prepared for a new round of actions against Venezuela. By the time this program is aired, the U.S. may have launched an attack on Venezuela. The U.S. pressure to oust Maduro from power appears to be a definitive goal. Why would a military buildup in the Caribbean underway for months and Trump to have authorized covert CIA operations? It may be just a matter of time before there is an invasion or targeting of sites inside Venezuela. I'm Kyarash Bunamati, and I'll see you next week.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. IRIB English Radio. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi,
Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
For weeks, tensions in the Caribbean have been intensifying. The latest flashpoint came after President Donald Trump posted on his Truth Social account that Venezuelan airspace should be considered closed in its entirety. Venezuela quickly slammed the move. The country's foreign minister denounced the move, calling it a colonialist threat and an unjustified aggression against the people of Venezuela.
Venezuela denounces and condemns the colonialist threat that seeks to affect the sovereignty of its airspace, constituting an illegal and unjustified aggression against the people of Venezuela.
As tensions rise over Venezuelan airspace, Washington faces mounting criticism abroad and at home. Cuba and Iran join in condemning Washington's posture, but more is expected from neighboring countries whose silence so far has raised questions about how the region will respond to escalating U.S.-Venezuela tensions.
But, I think most of the pressure lays on the shoulders of the neighboring countries, and that's to say Brazil, and that's to say also Colombia.
On Capitol Hill, Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer issued a sharp warning accusing President Trump of reckless actions that could push America into another costly foreign war. He said, Americans are tired of endless foreign wars that cost the lives of countless American service members and drain precious resources. So what is Washington's goal? The U.S. claims its actions are aimed at fighting cartels and drug trafficking. But analysts argue the real objective is to force Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro from power, either through pressure or the threat of military force.
And so there's a lot already in the region, and if there's even more on top of that, then one would think either that capability is going to be used or it's all sort of trying to demonstrate to President Maduro that it's either you leave the regime now and perhaps dictate some terms that are somewhat agreeable, or there will be a full-scale military operation to unseat you.
The U.S. has a long history of intervention in Latin America and the Caribbean, from Panama to El Salvador to Cuba. Critics say the latest pressure campaign against Venezuela fits that pattern, with troops already positioned in the Caribbean and rhetoric heating up. The standoff is no longer just about Venezuela's skies. It's about whether America is prepared to risk a wider conflict in its own backyard.
Crowds filled the 70 square of the Yemeni capital to mark Eid al-Jala, Yemen's national day celebrating the official end of British rule over South Yemen. What was once a commemoration of the historic liberation has become a platform for Yemenis to reaffirm their opposition to all forms of modern-day foreign occupation. Demonstrators waved pro-resistance flags and chanted slogans against any external interference, emphasizing that the spirit that drove the British out still shapes Yemen's national identity. Former Yemeni Prime Minister Abdelaziz bin Habtoud addressed the rally, condemning Saudi Arabia and the UAE for their interference in Yemen.
Today we are in a battle against the Saudi occupier, who is occupying parts of our lands, and also against the Emirates, who is occupying our islands and provinces. The people who came out today are sending a defiant message to the government that we are ready to defend every ounce of our land.
The main theme of the rally directed strong words at foreign-backed groups inside Yemen.
We came out today to tell the mercenaries and the agents that your end is near, and we are waiting for the orders to fight you and drive you out along with the Saudis and the Emirates.
Tribal leaders also used the occasion to express solidarity with regional resistance movements.
On this side, al-Jalal, the day our people expelled the last British soldier, we send a message to our brothers in Iran, Hezbollah, and the resistance in Palestine that we are with you. Your enemy is our enemy, and we will never forsake you no matter the challenges we face.
For Yemenis in Sana'a, Eid al-Jala remains both a reminder of past liberation and a renewed vow to confront any attempts at occupation in Yemen.
The protesters have delivered a clear message. Yemenis will not allow their country to fall under any form of occupation, nor will they tolerate any mercenary forces operating on behalf of foreign powers. Yusuf Audi, Sana'a.
They gathered in huge numbers in the Irish capital on Saturday to mark the UN-recognized International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people. The national march, organized by the Ireland-Palestine Solidarity Campaign, was backed by more than 170 Irish civil society groups. Protesters are urging the Irish government to finally pass the Occupied Territories Bill, which would prohibit Irish companies from trading with businesses operating inside illegal Israeli settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories.
The government made a pledge that they would pass that, and they haven't. And it can't just be about goods, it has to be about services. And the people of Ireland are demanding that. We voted for it, and they're just hiding behind politics.
Campaigners say the so-called ceasefire in Gaza is a fiction, pointing to ongoing Israeli violations and a mounting civilian death toll that adds to the tens of thousands already killed.
I'm opposed to genocide and apartheid. That's why I'm here. I've been marching for 2 years and I'll continue to march.
Humanitarian aid isn't getting in, the medical aid isn't getting in the sort of amounts they need. So it's still pretty desperate, and they're getting into wintertime there. You know, it's cold enough here today. You know, so what's it like if you're living in a tent that's in tatters?
It's a sad day for the world and a sad day for America, a sad day for Britain, sad day for Ireland, that the murder machine of Netanyahu continues.
Yeah, the conditions for people living there are intolerable, and it's not a proper ceasefire, and we're continuing to allow Israel to have people living in apartheid states, and it's not right, and we have a right to come out and protest and say it's wrong.
Activists are also calling on the European Union to impose robust sanctions on Israel and to ensure the Netanyahu administration is held accountable in international courts for its crimes against humanity. Because of their complicity and because they're not listening to the electorate, there's a good chance that political parties currently in government right across Europe could be punished when national elections next arise. We've already seen something similar here in Ireland. President Catherine Connolly was elected a landslide victory. She was very anti-establishment and very pro-Palestinian. Jerome Hughes, Dublin.
With the Israeli regime routinely violating the so-called ceasefire in Gaza and committing atrocities against the Palestinians in the West Bank, the thousands who have descended upon central London today say the importance of expressing solidarity couldn't be overemphasized.
There's no ceasefire. Gaza's still in a terrible state. The West Bank is creeping into an ever and ever worse state. And the media I'm reporting this, the mainstream media, that's why I'm here. And the least I can do is to be here in a bit of rain when people in Gaza are drowning in their tents in rain.
Organized for the 33rd time, it's a demonstration to also call attention to Britain's ongoing business-as-usual relations with the regime accused of genocide and with its so-called leaders wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes.
To see Britain and America trashing the international world order in order to support Israel as it commits terrible crimes in Gaza is a matter of deep shame.
To the racist in...
On the stage opposite Downing Street, they may not mention their name, but Palestine Action, the direct action group banned under terrorist laws by the Labour government for targeting Israeli weapons manufacturing sites on UK soil, is on many people's mind.
They have managed to mute all resistance all over Europe, and now if you are pro-Palestinian, you are a criminal, or you are, it's like we are losing our democracy here. It's very important to be here today, because this is one step towards fascism, which is developing everywhere.
everyone knows is a traitor.
There's also sympathy for the six of the 24 activists jailed by the British government for trying to stop those weapons destined for the Israeli regime.
And I think in any other situation, we would hear about these things. You know, we would hear about hunger strikes if they were connected to Ukraine, maybe, or to Sudan or Congo. There's something about Palestine which means they don't even get their voices heard through the people who are trying to be allies with them here, because they're censored through.
Nearly 50 years ago, the United Nations named today the International Day of Solidarity with the Palestinian people, marking Resolution 181 advocating for the partition of Palestine into two states.
And yet another national demonstration terminates outside the halls of power, with the thousands who have gathered here saying they're here to assert that ordinary people in Britain refuse to be silent while their government continues to support a regime that is accused of genocide. Saipur is up, London.
Long live Palestine!
Supporters of Palestine in South Korea joined International Day of Action on Saturday to protest Israel's genocide in Gaza and the West Bank, and to draw attention to the one-sided peace plan of U.S. President Donald Trump.
The closest this peace proposal gets to an acknowledgement of the statehood of Palestine is in small text at the end, stating, "Only after the conditions have been carried out, there may finally be a pathway to Palestinian self-determination," leaving the freedom of Palestinians not up to their own will, but rather once again in the hands of Israel and the imperialist United States.
The death toll of Palestinians killed by Israel reaches near 70,000 people after 2 years. We're reminded to look past the data.
It's been so long since the current genocide started, and we just see numbers and numbers and numbers, and we forget that these are individuals and these are people and they have families, and we need to remember that, and we need to remember the suffering of other people across the world and how we need to stand up for all of them.
As supporters of Palestine here have emphasized, responsibility for Israel's genocide is widely shared. South Korea continues to deepen ties with Israel, including hosting the Israeli ambassador for public events and expanding military cooperation, including the provision of components for Israeli fighter jets that are still bombing Gaza. Under the cover of a so-called ceasefire, Israel's killed hundreds of Palestinians and has again widened the conflict with deadly bombings of Lebanon and Syria. While now most countries have shifted to support Palestine, more active policies are needed.
Countries need to impose more sanctions, and they need to put more pressure on the country that is aiding Israel. Being the U.S.
Recent winter rains have destroyed thousands of displaced Palestinians' tents. The U.N. demands Israel allow Palestinians to receive much-needed humanitarian and food aid. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Venezuela has been the subject of intense media attention in recent months as the United States doubles down on its pressure aimed at overthrowing the government in Caracas. In the eastern state of Anzoátegui, an assembly of local leadership meets as part of a process to fortify the United Socialist Party, the PSUV, from the grassroots level.
What the Venezuelans want is peace, prosperity, and we have our own democratic system. We have elections. We are even electing at this moment communities and popular power all over the country.
Venezuela held another election on Sunday to vote on local projects at the communal level, which will be funded by the state. And while the spectacle continues on social media, daily routines seem unaffected.
Things are happening. People are going to the beaches. People are going to party. People are working, are studying. But we are also getting ready for any scenario. If the imperialism of the USA tries to attack Venezuela, we'll know how to answer. And we will prevail. Venezuelans, the only thing we want is to be respected. and for the world and for the great powers to respect our sovereignty, to respect our people and our self-determination.
Throughout the country, daily life continues for Venezuelans against the backdrop of the incessant campaign of aggression leveled by the United States against the country as the massive military buildup escalates in the Caribbean Sea.
Governor of Anzoátegui Luis José Mercado says while calm reigns, Venezuelans are prepared to defend their nation.
In our state of Anzoátegui, which is part of the Caribbean coastal region of our country, we have entered a period of permanent mobilization. What we have done for these past 3 months or more is carry out intense activity involving military, police, and popular mobilizations. Each of our 205 community circuits has an organization with militia units that have been mobilizing, holding night marches and meetings, conducting training exercises, and carrying out military-style preparations. In Venezuela, the majority of us, the women and men of this nation, are absolutely determined to preserve our independence and our sovereignty.
Venezuela is a country at peace, advancing in its various transformative projects, strengthening its economy in the face of the economic blockade, and guarding its sovereignty. Camila Escalante, Anzoátegui.
The rise and fall of civilizations has been endless. It's a natural process, the circle of life. No matter how majestic or insignificant some of these civilizations might have been, the ruins, the traces of their time on this earth are an invaluable part of our history.
The one important thing is what we can decipher from these ruins and the insight they might depart us. Iran is a land rich with ancient history. The burnt city, or Shahr-e Sukhte in Farsi, is a unique heritage and narrates the story of the Sistan and Balochistan region. The excavated findings from this site can fill some of the lost pages of the history of this land and its people.
This Bronze Age archaeological treasure trove is only about 6% of what it really was more than 5,000 years ago. It was once one of the world's largest communities at the dawn of civilization. Spanning 151 hectares of land, Shahr-e Sukhte sits along the Zahedan-Zabul Road. Findings show that the burnt city first appeared around 3200 BC and was abandoned over a millennium later around 1800 BC, experiencing four stages of urbanization. Some say that it was abandoned because of climate change and drought, but the actual reasons for its rise and unexpected fall are still a mystery. Built of mud bricks, the city appears to have had a large palace, separate neighborhoods for lodgings, industrial activities, and separate areas for the production of local goods. The grounds of this vast city is littered with broken pottery, hence one can conclude that pottery was produced here on a massive scale. Shahr-e Sukhte was first discovered in 1967 and has been continually excavated ever since the 70s. And yet, many sections are still left untouched. Only an estimated 4% has been excavated so far. The fascination of digging for buried treasure, exciting as it may be, is sweaty, tedious, and backbreaking work. Once the site's been chosen, archaeology students and workers, supervised by licensed archaeologists, carefully remove the ground cover, feeling for artifacts under the soil. They wash the findings and record the details of where they had been found. This is a long process and requires a great deal of delicacy and patience. To give you a hint, it may take roughly 10 years to completely excavate this small mound. In addition to the pottery ovens and the rubbish pits, many firsts were discovered during the excavations. The first animation drawn on a goblet. Once you spin the cup, you'll be able to see a goat jumping and grazing. The first board game, a ruler with half a millimeter accuracy, and many other astonishing tools. They were true masters of their time in urbanization, architecture, mathematics, science, medicine, and engineering.
An advanced city run by women. The burnt city is one of the rarest ancient cities in which women were responsible for handling the financial affairs of the family.
In December 2006, archaeologists came across something stunning. They found an artificial eye, would you believe? It belonged to a woman aged 32 to 36 and was estimated to have been about 4,800 years old.
One of the most astonishing finds of the city are traces of brain surgery on the skull of a 12 or maybe 13-year-old girl whose remains are over 4,000 years old.
To the west of the city is a huge cemetery that's about 25 hectares. The cemetery contains over 20,000 ancient graves, pointing to just how large the burnt city's population had been. More than 10 different types of graves were found at this location, four types of which were more common. Simple graves, graves with two sections, crypts and burial chambers. The latter is considered to be the most important one of all. Scientists believe that the variety of burial methods points to the coexistence of different cultures within one society in the burnt city. reconstructions of the excavated graves and some of the artifacts found in them at the Museum of the Burnt City, which is within a walking distance, just on the other side of the road. Some of the remains found in the excavated tombs are in the fetal position. Now, one hypothesis is that perhaps our ancient Sistani ancestors believed the position in which we were born was the proper way for us to leave the earth. Another characteristic feature of the tombs is the way husbands and wives were buried together, facing each other. There is still so much more, from different fabrics to makeup items, jewelries, and even raisins. However, neither what remains of the buildings nor their symbolisms has helped us understand how such an advanced city could have existed 5,000 years ago. What happened to them, and why did we lose all the knowledge that they had? In a corner of Iran, hidden beneath the veil of these plains, a mysterious civilization has left its trail. Maybe to show us just how remote and valuable Sistan and Baluchistan is. In every corner of this province, there is a path that leads us to a wondrous history. This is Golnar Farnoodi for Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en.